This week in left field football content, Chelsea hammer Spurs, are they scary? Yellow cards for taking your top off, North London derby on the horizon, and is Lionel Messi finally washed up? Enough football, why is the Ryder Cup must-see TV? Saracens are back in Premiership Rugby and taking souls, and taking taunting out of the NFL, good or bad? Enjoy the show. Welcome to Left Field, your favourite sports adjacent trashcast with me, your boy Wogan, and my good friend Andrew Allen. Andrew, are you well?
I'm well. Just before we came on air, it sounded like we were swapping notes on being tired.
Yeah, two different types of tired. You were at a respectable wedding. I was at a miscreant professional wrestling event in Bethnal Green. Two undoubtedly fun weekends.
Yeah, I want to know more about this wrestling event. Like, who was involved? What was the crowd like? Did they have fun names? Was there good intro music?
All of those things, yes. This was Revolution Pro Wrestling. They're one of their flagship shows called High Stakes, which was supposed to be last year, but it was postponed. I don't know if you've heard about the coronavirus. That sort of killed any notion of 2,000 very sweaty, smelly people screaming and shouting inside a packed York Hall. Very fun. Main event, particularly good. Ricky Knight Jr. against Will Ospreay. And of course, as you know, Andrew, Will Ospreay is the greatest wrestler in the world. So that was very, very fun. Lots of people got very drunk and was shouting and screaming. It was probably only 2/3 full or maybe 3/4 full. I think a lot of people have forgotten that because they bought the tickets 18 months ago. So there was a few empty seats, but a lot of fun had by all. And then the other thing I did at the weekend was I learned a lot about Jimmy Greaves, because unfortunately Jimmy Greaves died, and an odd sort of silver lining of when someone great dies, new generations learn all about them. And obviously not having grown up in England, I didn't grow up with, you know, grandparents telling me about Jimmy Greaves, whereas a lot of my contemporaries did. Tell me what you know about Jimmy Greaves, Andrew.
Jimmy Greaves was the really funny guy who was on the TV on Saturdays as a co-host of Saint and Greavesy. For me, you know, as a kid growing up, there weren't a huge number of football-related TV programs on. There was kind of like the big match when there was a game on, like ITV potentially. Obviously, Match of the Day, which everybody looked forward to, but when you were under the age of 10, you were never going to be allowed to stay up and watch. But this was a kind of like a daytime show that was, you know, it made fun of football, or it made football fun. It didn't take itself too seriously. I at the time didn't really register how good Jimmy Greaves was. I mean, physically, when you look at a guy who at that point was in his sort of late 50s, early 60s, I think, you know, that was not a guy who looked like he'd once been a prolific goal scorer. You know, he was a sort of round faced guy with a, you know, no hair, this moustache, this larger than life character, a bit of a reputation for a drink and all the rest of it. And he was just really amiable. And I think that stuck with me because, you know, lots of great players come and go, but everyone had a kind of soft spot for Jimmy Greaves. And it obviously is very tragic. I mean, I know that he had a stroke at a pretty young age back in the 70s, and he had some problems with alcoholism as well and his sort of retirement years. And it was interesting sort of seeing that play out on the same weekend that, you know, Paul Merson had been talking about all of his issues. You know, Paul Merson, who I guess for a generation now isn't really someone they necessarily recognize as being a footballer, but as a guy who's on TV and, you know, trying to bring a level of entertainment to football coverage and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's interesting just watching generation after generation of footballers kind of struggle after their careers end. And I think it's just such a big thing trying to prepare the next generation now through academies to become more prepared for life away from football. Sad news about Jimmy for sure. Even as a Spurs great, you know, I doffed my cap.
That's very big of you. I saw one of, I think Paul Merson was doing a lot of press this weekend. I think his book came out quite recently.
Yeah.
But I did see a clip of maybe a 5-minute segment of him on TalkSport talking really emotionally. And he does say these things can happen to anyone. It's not because I was a footballer, but I was watching it just going, I think it might be partly because you were a footballer. But I don't know. Who am I to know?
Well, look, obviously gambling affects all sorts of people. I mean, and addiction is an illness and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, Paul Merson's circumstances certainly lent it to exacerbating, I would imagine, the fact that he's got gambling problems and he's had issues with drugs and alcohol in the past. But I don't know, there's something very awkward, I think, about Paul Merson having a regular gig on Soccer Saturday when that show is so geared towards gambling now. It even has its kind of own inbuilt kind of prediction game, doesn't it? And it's just this sort of, I don't know, it all just feels a little bit like, this feels a bit awkward, right? You know, the problem gambler talking about gambler and making predictions.
Hold on, Andrew, if you're addicted to gambling, just when the fun stops, stop. It's as easy as that.
Yeah.
According to the adverts.
Yeah.
Let's do some fun stuff because this has kicked off very morbidly. Well, actually, our first good week isn't even good because I'm sort of scared of this team. London Derby, Chelsea 3, Spurs 0 at Spurs. Of all the results this weekend, this was the one that unsettled me the most because I now find Chelsea scary. Do you?
I mean, I've had a few weeks to feel a bit scared of Chelsea after they demolished Arsenal with these. They're looking very, very tidy. And even when they, I guess, had to go through the mill for 45 minutes with Spurs, Tuchel had the answer. You know, he switched things around at half time. He took off Mason Mount. He put on N'Golo Kante. I mean, not many signs in the world can bring on a player of that quality as a substitute at half time. Spurs just didn't have an answer. I think Romelu Lukaku now has an aura about him that he just did not have when he left Manchester United. He looks like a guy who could lead the line for any side in the world, and right now he's making Chelsea look like one of the best in the world. So I think, you know, there's a momentum that's being built up, obviously, off the back of winning the Champions League. They've had a big shot in the arm, you know, a side who this time last year looked a bit lost at times under Lampard. Not that many new players over the summer, you know, a couple maybe, but including Lukaku, obviously, who looks like he could be the missing piece in the jigsaw for them. But it does look like they're going to go toe-to-toe with the other big guns for the title.
I think I've read tweets on FPL Twitter saying that Chelsea have a very handy or kind run of fixtures between now and Christmas. I don't know if it's as kind as the run that Arsenal have. But it makes me think that at Christmas, Chelsea will be top of the league because they've got scary manager who makes, you know, in-game adjustments with an amazing bench at halftime, which is a very proactive thing that most managers don't do. They've got that scary striker. They've got scary attackers behind them. There's scary pivot players. Like Jorginho, Kante and Kovacic are all brilliant. Scary defenders, scary rotation options. They're scary. But there is also a possibility that Spurs are just shite. Because, I don't know, what happened to Harry Kane? He looks like some kind of ghost. Will Spurs regret not getting 120 million quid or whatever they could have got for him? He's not getting any younger. I don't mean to say he's old, but I just mean that he's at his peak of value. And yet he's walking around the pitch like he lost some of the motivation maybe that just made him a killer in previous years.
Well, I mean, I think last year, obviously, that start that he and Son made was like sensational, right? They were scoring and assisting for each other in every game. And that actually came off the back of that long standing narrative of Harry Kane starting the season a bit slowly. Remember, it always used to be, you took him he used to score in August or whatever it was. And, you know, maybe he's just returned to that. I do feel for anyone who's played an entire summer as long as he did up to the final and then gets sort of chucked in the deep end off the back of barely any preseason. I mean, he may claim that he wasn't expected back for that week of preseason or whatever it was when he was trying to push for the move to City. But it can't have done him any good to be away from a team with a new manager for that long. And Spurs just look a bit like they're feeling themselves out a little bit. They don't really know. They don't seem to have any kind of obvious discerning tactics. They've got a whole load of new players. Some look better than others. I think the centre-back looks all right-ish. Don't really know what to make of Emerson Royale, the right back. And is it Brian Hill, the yeah. kind of the sort of attacking midfielder? I haven't really seen anything from him to make me go, oh my God, he's going to tear up the league, and he's way better than Eric Lamella, for example. So
he has real 90s hair. That just makes me worried.
I think
he might
has
be good.
Real 70s hair. Like, I mean, he just looks like he's kind of, you know, like he's a schoolboy who grew up with not having his hair cut, and then, you know, it just was allowed to stay like that.
That's just your signature look now, Brian Heal.
Yeah.
Speaking of Chelsea, should Chelsea be worried about a potential title challenge by Brighton? They're the other hot in-form team in the title race.
Yeah, I mean they've racked up, what's that, 12 points already? I mean, it's incredible given they only got 41 in the whole of last season.
Well, they famously underperformed against their XG and XGA and their expected points last year. Now they're currently overperforming their expected points by 5 points. And now, like last year, we were like, oh, when will they kick on and start finishing? Now I'm like, oh, when will they regress and stop finishing?
Yeah. I mean, I would say as wonderful a start as it is, you know, there's always like one side, isn't there, that seems to kind of go on a bit of a run like this. And you look at the fixtures they've had, they've beaten Burnley, they've beaten Watford, they lost to Everton, they beat Brentford, and they've beaten Leicester. Now, beating Leicester is no mean feat. But they haven't played any of the scary teams just yet, you know. So I imagine there'll be a kind of a moment in the season where they get a run to, you know, against the big boys, and suddenly they're struggling and they'll be back down to mid-table, and they'll be down to about 15th and 16th, and everything will be kind of as it was last year, just in reverse.
Did you see Neil Mopay's penalty? He kicked it really hard. I love when penalties are just kicked really hard. It's like, oh, you've really kicked that ball. Well done.
Where did he put it? Roof of the net. Feels
middle,
like it has to be.
Sort of middle height, but right into the left side of the actual like side netting.
Nice.
I don't like middle height. Always makes the keeper look good when they save it, but that's the perfect height. But he did just kick it really hard, so well done, Neil Mopay. It seems to have been spent the whole summer practicing kicking the ball into the net, because that's what he was shied at last year.
there were quite a few goals this weekend which involved players just spanking the ball really hard. I think my favourite of the entire weekend was probably Leon Bailey's one.
Oh, yeah, that was great. Oh, well, actually, great opportunity to move on, because I was going to mention him in our next segment. Bad week, goal celebrations. Leon Bailey got a yellow for taking off his shirt in Aston Villa's 3-0 win over Everton. Mo Salah also got a yellow in a 3-0 win when Liverpool beat Crystal Palace. Slightly different, but Jesse Lingard refused to celebrate when he scored the winner for United against West Ham, because he played there on loan for 6 months last year. You know, it doesn't really seems a bit hollow to me. The yellow card rule, I was going to ask you, the obligatory yellow card for taking your shirt off. I know this is not news, but like, it annoys me. It's been like this for what, a decade or something like that? You just get an automatic yellow card for taking off your shirt. I think the point of the rule is that, you know, they don't want players wearing advertising slogans or political slogans, or just even if they don't want them probably accidentally promoting the wrong kind of undershirt. But it just comes across as annoying, because if I look like Mo Salah, I wouldn't own any shirts. I'd refuse to wear one. Someone needs to take this pun and make the joke better, but he puts the delt in Nile Delta.
It's the actual rule, which is apparently Law 12 set by the International Football Association Board, IFAB, is very vague and doesn't actually specifically say why a player should get booked for having his shirt off. It just says if the shirt is off, it's a booking, and it doesn't matter really what occasion that is. So a player could celebrate a goal. The goal could be chalked off by VAR, and if he's taken his shirt off in that process, the referee will give him a yellow card and he won't then reverse it. I was trying to look into a bit of research about when it was sort of introduced, and they reckon it was around about 2004-2005 after Diego Forlan scored in the Premier League for Manchester United against Aston Villa. It was his first goal. He took his shirt off, celebrated madly, and then couldn't get the shirt back on, and the game restarted. And there's a clip of him, you can find it. It restarted with him holding his shirt, and there was no break in play, and he ends up making a tackle topless. And this is kind of slightly ridiculous situation. And because the shirts were, I don't know whether it was like the shirt had got wrapped up in the undershirt and all the rest of it. It took three people to get it back on him.
God.
Obviously, you know, people watching that decided, oh, we can't be having this. So, yeah. And also they don't like people celebrating excessively. It's kind of deemed ungentlemanly. Well, I say ungentlemanly, unsporting is probably the term we should use these days.
We have a bit of that in not football later when we get to the NFL. It's doing my head in. I want all celebrations to just be insane. Like, yeah. Mo Salah has impossible abs. Like, maybe that's been interpreted as offensive, or, you know, it's going to get someone too hot under the collar. I don't get it. Just let them take their tops off. Like, remember, how old was I at the time? I was a kid when Ryan Giggs ripped his shirt off after that famous goal that you hate. And we're, I don't know. Yeah, we must have been small kids because we're like looking at this dude's hairy chest and just going, oh my God, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you wouldn't more find like a Premier League player with a chest like that these days.
Well, that used to be what Mo Salah looked like. I remember seeing like a holiday picture from Mo Salah like 5 or 6 years ago before he obviously got on incredible asthma medication. And he just looked like a hairy average dude. And now he's, I presume, waxed or shaved and absolutely ripped as fuck.
Do you think clubs hire official in-house waxers to kind of, because you never see hairy legs on players either anymore. Like,
I've never really thought about the legs.
Hairless beings, most of them.
Yeah, maybe. If they have in-house barbers, why would they not have in-house, you know, other groomers? Groomers, like their dogs.
Yeah, imagine getting a gig like that. I'm going to be the official Liverpool team waxer.
Like, someone is the kit man, which is ostensibly washing shirts. So why can't someone be the official barber, the official groomer, true, the official back waxer? Like, I've never seen a player take his shirt off and have a hairy back. Like, but some of them must do, surely.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's literally not a podcast out there that isn't sponsored by some form of manscaping tool or something, apart from ours, obviously. Maybe off the back of this conversation, someone will approach us.
Yeah, big grooming needs to get involved.
Just going back to that Lingard goal, I'm going to say, I don't know if you were watching, but the West Ham fans were singing, you know, we want you to come home, or it's time to come home, it's time to come home, Jesse Lingard, yeah, he wants to come home, or something, just before, obviously, he scored. And I was just thinking to myself, as they were singing that about 10 minutes before the end of the game, that is quite possibly the single most naive chant I've heard by a football crowd in, I don't know, a good few years.
It feels like, well, two things. It feels like it's really tempting fate. You know, he is going to now score against you because you're singing to him. But also, it's a bit Desi. Like, oh, God. Very desperate of the West Ham fans.
Very desperate.
Have also, some self-respect, dudes.
Lingard's been on the books at Manchester United since he was 7. So the chances are the 6 months he spent in East London is unlikely for him to be home, I would imagine. But
I mean, it wasn't even 6 months. What was it? January until May. So 5 months. It was like a sort of a summer holiday type of thing, a summer romance that they'll just never forget and they'll be talking about in years to come.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm kind of, even though, you know, I'm not paying too much attention to the fantasy football stuff. Oh, Benrahma scoring again was something I did pay attention to. But I'm kind of very desperate for West Ham to have a terrible season, because I just don't want them to get above their station. It's got nothing to do with someone we know.
Well, in the our West Ham friend that we have in common would be completely obnoxious, and for Arsenal to drop further in like the official pecking order of London clubs would be desperate.
Yeah, I don't think I could cope with it. Not another year. And also, I think I mentioned this previously. In a sort of piece for Arse blog, I jokingly promised everyone reading £50 if West Ham come above Arsenal for a second successive season. So I'm in the hole for, I don't know, money I can't pay.
I think you can access the CMS. I would very quickly. Good week for, you mentioned Arsenal, good week for Arsenal. Second 1-0 Premier League win in a row, beating Burnley away. That single goal doubled the number of goals that they've scored in the Premier League so far, which is an impressive feat. It's not often that you can say that. Are Arsenal good now?
If they are, I don't really know. I mean, I've had weddings the last two Saturdays and we've won both the games. So maybe I need to go to like another 33 weddings or something this season. And
wedding crash.
Yeah. Well, I watched the game back on Sunday morning in its entirety, and Arsenal kind of produced a really gritty performance. You know, I don't think there was anyone out there who didn't think that, you know, Arsenal against Burnley was going to play out in one way, and it was going to be an aerial bombardment against a load of players who've regularly failed that type of test before. So it has to be said, it was very pleasing to be checking my phone while on MC duty and see us go 1-0 up and then, you know, hold out for a 1-0 win. It's a completely rebuilt defence, you know, as from the side that lost 5-0 to Manchester City. I think only Kieran Tierney's there in the back line. You know, Ramsdale's in goal and looking quite good, and I think he's sort of really won over the Arsenal fans by just being a nice boy.
Really quick. I was listening to 606 with Robbie Savage and Chris Sutton, and some Arsenal geezer rings in and he's just like, that boy Ramsdale, he's a revelation. It's like, that was so quick. Obviously Arsenal fans are slightly Desi as well, they just really want someone to love.
Well, maybe there's something to be said for having a kind of chippy northerner between the sticks rather than a slightly sulky German. It's
slightly more endearing.
Yeah, I mean, we've done both regularly in our history. You know, we've had David Seaman, who was, I think, from Yorkshire, and obviously Jens Lehmann, who was from Germany as well. So, Ramsdale's really won everybody over, and he's doing all the little things right. You know, he celebrates massively when the ball goes in, all twice this season, I might add.
Yeah.
And, you know, he goes and hands his shirt to little kids at the end of the game. You know, it's it doesn't take much to win over fans who really just want a sign that you're one of them. And that's what he seems to be doing.
Arsenal fans are a bit like a rescue dog. Like, they just really, they're full of love and they're ready to go, but they have been hurt. And, you know, now this is the forever home.
Yeah.
A
schizophrenic rescue dog, you know, prone to mad moments, unfortunately, you know. Not quite sure who's leading who. If we win the North London Derby at the weekend by two goals, Arsenal will go above Spurs, which will be the greatest sort of 10-day turnaround since people were posting pictures of the first ever time that Spurs have been top and Arsenal have been bottom. But
you mention it, you may as well give us a little taster preview. What is going to happen in the North London Derby this weekend? Are Arsenal going to win?
Well, I mean, you were joking about the fact that Arsenal have scored only two goals. We've only created three big chances all season.
That sounds like a suspiciously FPL type stat.
No, I didn't find it there, but so I read it somewhere else. But Spurs have only created two big chances, and they've won three games. So between
how did
us,
they do that?
I have no idea. It must have been an own goal or something. But between us, five big chances across what's, you know, 10 games of football. It doesn't speak to it being a high-scoring game, but
it does feel like it 0-0. And also, both teams will just really, really not want to lose that game. Because a draw, you can just, you know, you keep going, you keep doing your thing. But if one team loses, they're suddenly the team in crisis. Does feel like a 0-0. I was going to ask you about Aubameyang. Does he still play up front for Arsenal? Like, I was just thinking about this recently because I was looking at I have Aubameyang in a fantasy draft team. And I'm very committed to this gimmick that I want him to be successful. But I look back through his career statistics and he was very prolific for quite a long time. And then for the past 18 months, just hasn't really ever scored. Like, well, when is he going to pull out a few goals?
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, he was very, very prolific up until Arsenal won the FA Cup, thanks to him. You know, the two goals against Chelsea, completely unexpected win, really.
Was it the contract that did it?
And then he got the new contract.
Yeah.
And he's really struggled. I mean, to be fair, he has scored, I mean, if you count a hat-trick in the Carabao Cup and the goal against Norwich, he has scored four goals this season, which is, not an unreasonable, circumstance off the back of not many games. But he's not playing as part of a functioning attack. I think that's the problem.
And also, they are official statistics, so I can't officially take them away from him. But scoring a couple of goals against West Brom under 23s in the Carabao Cup shouldn't actually count as a statistic.
Yeah, all right, fair. I don't know is the honest answer. I'm hoping that, you know, he'll turn things around and it's not kind of some inexorable decline like a Fernando Torres that just sort of happens before your eyes and Alexis Sanchez did the same thing at Arsenal. You know, he just sort of started to tail off, and then when he moved to Manchester United he just continued to do that as if he completely lost his mojo.
If I was getting 300 grand a week to just show up, I would lose the fire in my belly, I think.
Yeah, well, you know.
Does he play up front? Like, is he gets moved around a bit?
No, he's been playing up front the last couple of games. He's led the line on his own. I don't think Lacazette's not started a game this season, I don't think. So that will change in midweek when we play Wimbledon and AFC Wimbledon and the Carabao Cup. But for the weekend, I fully expect it to be Aubameyang leading the line. Yeah, unless there's any kind of injury issue. But he's still getting the nod. And I think most Arsenal fans, that's where they want to see him playing. They don't really want to see him on the left and Lacazette up front. But, you know, arguably a couple of years ago under Emery, the two of them playing like that did actually do all right. You know, they scored a fair few goals. So, I can't hide the fact that I'm concerned about Aubameyang. And just watching the games recently, it feels like we're getting more solid at the back. The midfield is starting to work things, but there's this issue that Aubameyang is not Lukaku. And I think, that's going to be the big difference between Arsenal and, well, one of the many differences between Arsenal and Chelsea this season. Sorry, I had to correct myself there.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's funny. Your problem is Aubameyang is not not Lukaku. Yeah. I don't know how we fixed that for you. Speaking of players who are overpaid and not scoring, bad week, Lionel Messi, subbed off by Pochettino in his debut for Paris Saint-Germain and seemingly not very happy about it. My question for you, Andrew, is Lionel Messi washed up?
Yeah, he's done with goals, isn't he now?
He's washed up. He's done. He's over. He should go off to the MLS, into Miami.
To clarify, his home debut.
Yeah.
And I mean, he played a few minutes away from home in one of the games. And then I think he played all of the game in the Champions League against Club Brugge, maybe, where they drew and he didn't score in that. I had the game on last night and I was sort of watching, and it was Jonathan Pearce in the commentary, and he's, you know, obviously very keen to big up the moment. And Jonathan Pearce teed up, commentary wise, the first goal that Lionel Messi was ever going to score for PSG perfectly, because he put Messi had a free kick about 35 yards out first half. He stood over it and you knew exactly where he was going to put it, curl it, and he hit that kind of cross the corner bit at the top of the bar, and Jonathan Pearce, you could tell, would like, fuck, I fucked it, I've used all the good lines now, and spent most of the rest of the game kind of hoping that maybe some other drama took place, which inevitably it did. It was, you know, Pochettino taking him off the pitch as they were desperately trying to sort of scrabble for a winner, and he threw on Icardi, who's really not been very fancied. And I don't know, it went down too well with Messi or the crowd, but it paid off for Pochettino. It was a good header by Icardi to win it right at the death. And Leon had been pretty decent and very solid. We'll feel a bit screwed over there. But, I mean, PSG not looking great, but won, I think, all of their games in Ligue 1 so far. So
well done to them. Barcelona was like completely built around Messi, so I do sort of get it. Like, they had successive managers and systems, even like who came into the team and who went out of the team via transfers. All of that was built around Messi's ever presence. And now to plug him into a different existing setup, especially one with loads of very established stars like Neymar and Mbappe, is harder than plugging in, for comparison, Cristiano Ronaldo into Manchester United, because Ronaldo, at least now in the latter part of his career, plays a very classic striker role that just plugs in, whereas Messi doesn't do that. He plays this, he just plays this Messi role where he just runs around and then picks up the ball and then runs at people. I can see why it's harder. But the funnier take is that he's washed, he's crap now. So I'm going to go with that.
Did you see Erling Haaland's crazy goal for Dortmund at the weekend?
Yeah, it was a good goal.
It was, I mean, it was sort of a bit of a punt, I guess, and it looked good. I mean, the ball was played over the top and he's sort of chasing after it and the goalkeeper comes out and he gets there before the goalkeeper and kind of, I don't know how you'd even really describe what he did, but he sort of jumped in the air and kicked it and it kind of went up high, looped and then bounced into the net. And it was a kind of pretty unique goal. If anything, it reminded me a bit of the kind of opportunistic strike that Zlatan Ibrahimovic scored against England a few years ago, that's of random overhead kick.
That's what I was going to say, but I didn't want to make the comparison because it's definitely not as good or unusual
as that. It
is like 10% of that.
Yeah.
A sort of a flying lob. But it is good. He's clearly good at football.
And someone's going to buy him and it's going to transform their team. And
someone's going to buy him for like 200 million quid. Like, he's just insanely good.
The question, I guess, is, you know, if Mbappe goes to Real Madrid on a free, which he'll be eligible to do from January, and then you've got Haaland available in the market, and Manchester United have got too many strikers, and Spurs don't want to sell. He's going to end up at City, isn't he, Haaland? Where is dad playing?
Well, there's only a couple of clubs in the world that can afford them. So
Barcelona can't do it at the moment. So
yeah, exactly. So the list is, you know, is it even five clubs? I was going to say you count them on one hand. It's probably two or three clubs who could afford him.
Does he go to PSG? Who'll be willing to pay the money and will have just lost Mbappe and be looking for another star?
That sounds about right to me, yeah.
So it's PSG or Man City then. Great.
Hooray! Can't wait for the Champions League next season. Last good week for David Dunn. Funniest bit of the weekend for me. Raul Jimenez trying to Rabona across against Brentford and just absolutely stacking it. Do you think this was more embarrassing than David Dunn's famously shite Rabona? Like, is David Dunn going to be given a break as the king of the shite Rabona?
I don't know. I saw that David Dunn had tweeted to Eric Lamella last season, welcome to the Rabona team, when Lamella scored that amazing Rabona goal against Arsenal.
In a game that they lost.
In a game that they lost, yeah. Yeah, the goal basically didn't count. David Dunn's one for me is more comical. I don't know. There's just something about his sort of dumpy English body that kind of brings it to the, you know, it makes it more Benny Hill like. Raul Jimenez, I feel like there's a bit of sympathy there because of the head injury. And
yeah, David Dunn really does fall face first. And I think David Dunn had a reputation as this sort of like wannabe champagne player. Yeah. Whereas Jimenez, yeah, there is a sort of lot of goodwill from neutrals because of his injury for Jimenez. So I don't know if he's going to become the poster boy for the shit Rabona. Like, it is funny that it is nearly 20 years now, because I think it was 2003, David Dunn has been the poster boy for the bad Rabona, and Eric Lamella is the poster boy for the lesser spotted good Ramona, or good Rabona. Rabonas are just generally bad. The idea that anyone is the poster boy for good Rabonas is ridiculous to me, but Eric Lamella has done too, so he's therefore the king of it.
Yeah, I always had you down as a kind of, I don't play with this kind of nonsense frilly football.
Well, I do. I definitely played frilly football for like an under-15s Wicklow District Schoolboys League player. But I drew the line at the Rabona because I took much more pride in being able to actually kick with my left foot.
Could you actually do a Rabona, though? Someone asked you, if someone sort of laid a ball off to you and you're running and you were asked to do a Rabona and get height on it, do you think you could do it?
No, I couldn't. I'd never practiced it ever. Like, I would I'd have a go at someone expecting me to do a Rabona by saying no, because I've been practicing kicking with my left foot for years and years and years. So I'll just use that instead. I got annoyed at Jimenez. Use your left foot, mate.
Jimenez got annoyed at himself eventually in that game. He missed a header in the second half and he threw his protective headgear onto the turf, seemingly channeling the frustrations of all Wolves supporters who, I guess, after a half-decent start, even though they lost their first few games, people are excited about the type of football. But now they've, you know, only had one win in five games, and they're starting to look like they could be in trouble.
Poor Wolves. After the break, not football.
Here's Lingard. Jesse Lingard! It is the scenario that West Ham fans were dreading. The player who reignited his career on loan here last season.
Not football starts with golf. Who would have thought? The Ryder Cup starts at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin this Friday. Are you excited about the Ryder Cup?
I'm quite excited, actually.
It's been three years.
Yeah, it's one of those. I'm hoping that it's still going strong on Sunday evening by the time I get back from Arsenal to be able to kind of tune in and watch a bit of it, because there's a fairly high chance if I'm out having a few beers before the football. I'm going to miss a good chunk of the last day. I had a little look at the course. I saw there was someone had put a nice YouTube video together with a drone. Looks very interesting. Apparently based on an Irish Lynx course. It's on the shores of Lake Michigan. Looks very dramatic, very picturesque.
Yeah, I looked up some pictures of Whistling Straits earlier and was just like, nah, that's wrong, because that looks like a Scottish or Irish course.
Yeah, it's been designed like that by a guy who just seemed to have an unending budget. And it's incredible. I'd love to play golf on a course like that. I mean, I'd lose so many balls, absolutely, shanking them straight into the sea.
It's near Sheboygan, which is a very enjoyable city name to say.
That is incredible. I have no idea how you spell that.
Sheboygan, like Sheboygan.
Sheboygan.
In Wisconsin. Isn't that exciting?
We've been over Wisconsin before.
The Sconies, is that what we decided to call them?
I think so, yeah.
Sconies. Why do we like the Ryder Cup? I was trying to think of, like, why? A couple of things. Very easy team colours, red versus blue. And they don't really mess around with the designs. It's you're wearing a red shirt, you're wearing a blue shirt. It's very clear. Very high drama makes otherwise unremarkable golfers quite exciting. Less days than a regular golf tournament, I think three rather than four, which I feel is nicer, Friday to Sunday. There's an illusion that golfers are very individual because they play so alone, but the Ryder Cup does show that they're actually mates. And I think the whole shared experience of it is why the players really want to play in it. Like, they really give a shit about the Ryder Cup. Also, ludicrous amount of captains, or like vice captains. That's quite good. You just get all these older players walking around. I don't know what they're contributing at all. Like, are they booking the hotels or whatever? Are they organizing the set menu for dinner? And all of that just adds up to making the Ryder Cup very, very good hangover viewing, IMHO.
That is a great shout. Hangover viewing. It is. I mean, it's kind of it does feel very kind of penalty shootouty as well. It so often has that level of drama where you're just not quite sure who's going to be the one who makes the fatal mistake. And I mean, it's quite an exciting lineup this year. I mean, the Americans obviously have got this big issue with DeChambeau and Koepka in the same lineup, and trying to figure out whether the fireworks will be going off there. I recognize most of the people in the Europe team. but there's definitely a few names I do not. Weisberger, no idea. Hovland.
I had never heard of a good few of these people. Like, in the American team, I'd never heard of Harris English or Daniel Berger, I don't think, or Scotty Scheffler. And then in the European team, who was I not sure of? Oh, Tyrrell Hatton? Apparently, he's been really good at golf for like the last 4 years. And I'm like, I'm sorry, mate. I'm sorry to this man. I've never heard of you.
I mean, an American side that's got a Schofield and a Scheffler. That's, you know, that's incredible naming.
Feels like the next one up would be a Stifler.
Stifler playing for the Ryder Cup would really be an incredible turn of events, I would have thought.
Did you read, The Guardian did a piece about Anthony Kim a couple of days ago. He was a young Korean-American golfer, I believe, who won a couple of tournaments and was like very, very good for the US Ryder Cup team in, I think, 2008. And then within a couple of years, he had just vanished from the face of the earth, and now nobody ever hears from him. Like, he's a ghost.
Oh God, I've literally just found the article. I'm going to have to read that.
He's a mystery,
that's
man.
That's very weird. No, there's, I mean, this, I remember him as well, yeah.
There's this story. I haven't really checked into. Yeah, I'm sure I wouldn't be the one that's going to figure out what the crack is with Anthony Kim. But there was a story that he had.
Do yourself like, down.
He had some kind of insurance for if he ever had a career-ending injury. For like $10 or $20 million or something like that, and he did his Achilles or something, and was just like, "All right, my career's over, so I'm out. See you later. I'm rich already. Bye."
Take the money and run.
Yeah, or
not run if you've got an Achilles problem, but you know.
No, or you're a golfer.
Yeah, true. So who's going to win? Do you care? I mean, obviously, we'd like Europe to win, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
I still have to do a double take when I see John Rahm and the European side because I keep thinking of
John Hamm. I guess the European team because it's got Irish guys on it. Why are all the British guys on it? I thought you voted to leave.
Do you think that should have come in?
Yeah, they don't identify as European.
I mean, if they just put that as a kind of like fundamental reason, like in the, like the, one of the major debates that the British guys wouldn't be allowed to play in the Ryder Cup team.
Doesn't Ian Poulter wear like Union Jack pants or something? Have I just made that up?
I don't believe he's worn them for the Ryder Cup, has he? I mean, obviously they've got their own uniforms, but I know that he's done that in the past when he's, you know, flying solo. Big Arsenal fan, Polks. I have to say, what I am always amazed about is there's so many of the same names always end up in the team, right? Like Sergio Garcia, Poulter, McIlroy. I mean, fucking Lee Westwood must be about 80 by now, and he's still.
Captain's picks. Like, especially on the American side, half of the team are captain's picks and half of them are qualifiers. There's a lot more qualifiers than captain's picks on the European team, but it's just like, right, there's a few guys and you can play your way into the team. Otherwise, I'm going back to my old reliables. Like Sergio Garcia and Ian Poulter are not qualifying for this year's tournament, but they're like fiery. They must be good locker room guys.
What's the deal with, there's no Phil Mickelson in that United States team. Is he now like, is he done with the Ryder Cup? Because I can't remember a Ryder Cup without him in it.
I think he's a vice captain this year.
So he's on the meal duty. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's walking around doing a whip round for whoever it's birthday it is, you know.
Fair. Cool.
Looking after the caddies. Well, probably also a good locker room guy with those big calves of his and his sort of weird used car salesman energy. Let's do rugby. Premiership rugby is back. And ominously, Andrew, so are those cheating bastard Saracens. Saracens beat Bristol fairly handily at the weekend. That's Bristol who topped the table last year. Leicester are also back, I noticed. Sort of old money in the Premiership. They beat Exeter City Seawards. And Ellis Genge is their new captain. I quite like Ellis Genge. Here's a question. Do you know anything about the new 50-22 rule? Have we discussed this before?
I have literally no idea what you're talking about. 50-22 rule.
Yeah, so there's this new rule. The stats department will tell me if I butcher this summary. It's a trial rule that the Premiership are using this year, where if you kick the ball from inside your own half, that's the 50, into the other team's 22, and it bounces and goes into touch, then you would get the line out. It would be your ball in the line out. So that's to encourage
massive kicks.
Well, it incentivizes massive kicks, yeah, but it also means that defending teams without the ball would theoretically have to leave more players back, which they don't currently do. And the effect of that in modern rugby has been that the defensive line will just be like 13 or 14 guys all across, and it's just shit to watch. So the idea is that maybe two players will have to drop back. So you could only have, for example, 12 or 11 in the line, which should make for more interesting rugby. And I think it's a good idea, but they do also have this in rugby league, and there's an unintended consequence that it's now potentially much more attractive to try and ping a kick than to run from your own half, which is where a lot of highlight play comes from. You know, they go the whole length of the field. So I don't know how this is going to work, but it has made me more interested in watching Premiership rugby this year, just to see how it goes.
Talking of highlights, a bit harder to come by this season because it's coming off Channel 5, apparently.
Oh, dear.
So the casual viewer will have to catch up online, where apparently they're doing a very comprehensive roundup. I've got another little rugby tidbit, because the United Rugby Championship, which used to be known as a Pro 14, is starting this weekend. It's been rebranded, and all of those games are going to be kind of like available free to air in various places. I mean, so the United Rugby Championship, which has got clubs from Scotland, Italy, Wales, Ireland, and South Africa.
Yeah.
Which makes it sound glamorous, but for every time I ever tune in, it looks like it's just the same teams playing each other.
Yeah.
Like a load of Welsh regions playing derbies every other week.
Connacht versus Scarlets.
Yeah.
Every week forever.
I was reading that they're in their coverage, though, they're going to introduce XP, expected points.
No.
So rugby is basically playing catch up with the rest of the stats world. And a couple of guys have been working on creating a new formula that basically figures out what players are doing on the pitch and whether they're worthwhile and what their little mistakes cost their team as well. So, it could be an interesting one. I imagine, you know, as with anything new, it will be met with a lot of cynicism. It's fair to say that XG still gets greeted in some quarters in football with a kind of like, oof, poof, you know, poo-pooed by the old school. But it's going to be kind of real-time stuff. It's going to be showed up. Players' worth on the pitch is going to suddenly be, you know, highlighted in a completely different way, which I guess for someone like me who's not a massive rugby watcher is kind of curious to see how that plays out.
I'm struggling to get my head around how that would work. I've never really spoken to people who talk about rugby statistics. Like, even our mate Squidge analyzes it really qualitatively.
Yeah.
And picks apart, you know, movements and plays and all of that kind of thing. But I don't really recall even Squidge being particularly stat heavy.
Well, I just think that the stats haven't been available. So there's not been anybody really trying to collate the data. So they're really talking about like heavy tackles, offloads, like winning penalties, passes, like being given a, you know, weighted accordingly, I guess, and then totting all of that up to give the player a kind of end of game score, which, yeah, I mean, it could be really interesting to see, because there'll be some players that people have never heard of who are suddenly going to be like looked at in a completely different light, guys who do loads of kind of under the radar dirty work. But there's a good article in the Telegraph about it. I'll just see if I can find it. It is by Charlie Morgan. So it's worth checking out if you can be asked.
Well done, Charlie Morgan, for doing a great article. Good job, you. My favorite rugby stat ever is always how much the pack weighs. It's like, what? 960 kilos. You're like, oh, they're big boys, big meaty men slapping meat. Speaking of big meaty men slapping meat, NFL week two done. The most annoying thing this weekend, I watched a bit of NFL Red Zone. The NFL is cracking down on taunting. that's their word for like overzealous celebration that may offend another team.
Oh, God,
it's like what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
They give, I can't remember how many times I saw it, but it was so annoying. They're just giving these crazy penalties all over the place for like basically every celebration is interpreted as taunting, like offending the team that you're dunking on. And it just, it's so annoying that why the fun police always have to ruin everything? Like, one of the biggest joys in American football is defensive backs feverishly celebrating incomplete passes that they were 5 yards away from doing anything about, like hulking up as if they had anything to do with it whatsoever. And now they could be subject to a 15-yard penalty just for sort of getting too hyped. Stinks. Stinks, Andrew.
I mean, it sounds like NFL's become even less attractive for me to watch than it ever was before. Although, obviously, very excited about the New Orleans Saints. I'm sure they'll do great this season. And I will be backing them and plan to watch the Super Bowl again this year, hopefully with you.
I love the hesitation around the word February. Super Bowl. Like, you're like, what do they call it again? The Super Saints. Something or another.
The massive trophy, the big
the
bowl.
The superb L. Yeah, it was like the NFL officials saw the Key and Peele Hingle McCringleberry sketch and just thought that's what we should actually do. Like, what people think we're a joke about, we're actually going to double down on it. In general, celebrations should be as offensive to the other team as possible. Like,
absolutely. 100% agree.
Are you familiar with the Texas Longhorns horns down symbol?
I think you asked that question knowing full well that I'm going to say no.
It's the sort of general interest thing I thought you'd be interested in. Like, the Texas Longhorns do this like horns symbol, you know, like with your index finger and your pinky finger up.
Jesse Lingard do that? Okay.
Well, yeah. Jay Lings does this great radio.
It's the other way around. You've literally turned your hands the other way around. I mean,
he does that, right?
Okay.
Doing a J and an L, Jay Lings. So the Texas Longhorns do this horns thing. But if you want to offend someone who loves the Texas Longhorns, which is basically everyone in Texas, you do horns down. You just reverse the symbol and do it upside down. And if you play against the Longhorns and do the horns down gesture, the Big 12, the conference that runs their games, says that it could actually be interpreted as an offensive gesture and you could be given a penalty. Like, you're flipping the bird at them. It's just made up. Like, in Texas,
it's just
people,
for them.
Yeah, Texas people absolutely hate it. I remember there's a wrestler called Britt Baker, who's also a dentist, and she cut a promo in Texas, I think, last year, and she referred to their chubby Whataburger faces. Apparently, Texas people love Whataburger, and then did the horns down. And in the space of 5 seconds, I've never heard anyone get booed more for anything in my whole life. These people are insane.
What did the NFL have an image problem? Were they concerned about polluting the minds of young players who were, you know, in high school teams, sort of making crazy celebratory gestures in the faces of their peers? Was this an issue? Is it kind of born out of the Bible Belt? Some kind of Christian-ish issues going on?
I don't know. I actually can't figure out why they've done it, because it's just really making a rod for your own back, isn't it? Just like, right, I'm going to double down on this thing that everyone sort of likes and no one was really complaining about.
Is there a kind of like Mike Riley kind of head of the professional game match officials, you know, association people? Like, is there an equivalent of him? Is it kind of a drab former official who runs the rules over the roost and decides whether or not to start changing things?
There might be. I should probably look into the lore. Maybe there is a sort of Mike Riley equivalent. I know that everyone hates the commissioner, Roger Goodell.
Everyone hates the commissioner. I mean, if you have the name like the commissioner, I mean, how could he not be hated?
It's such a good name. Like, if you were like, oh, I'm the commissioner of the NFL. Oh, wow. That's...
Oh, you commission things, do you? Oh, yeah. Yes, the NFL.
Yeah. The top dog. The CEO. I'd like if normal CEOs were just called the commissioners. Like, I'm the commissioner of... BHB Billiton. And finally, since we recorded last week's pod, the world lost one of its funniest people in Norm MacDonald, the comedian. Who is your favorite comedian ever?
We're ashamed about Norm. I've been watching a lot of clips, and
my YouTube algorithm is completely fucked from watching Norm Macdonald clips for the last week.
That is some seriously dry wit. Who is my favorite ever comedian? That's a good question. I have a very soft spot for Harry Enfield's old skits, I have to say. I mean, it's not a kind of like a stand-up. It's not very edgy. It was all very kind of, you know, situational. But yeah, I kind of really enjoyed them.
Loads of money.
Loads of money. You know, there was all the, there was a Swiss Tony. I mean, that was a Farce Show character. I mean, the guys in the Farce Show, which is Paul Whitehouse, is included in them. You know, brilliant. And even actually the old Kevin and Perry stuff, and it's when it first came out, was really very funny.
Kevin and Perry, I think, got very famous, and then people all just decided it was rubbish. Whereas in years to come, there's going to be a retrospective on Kevin and Perry, and people are going to be like, "That's some of the most genius shit ever."
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, Kathy Burke, isn't it? She's incredible. She was so funny as well, like, in her own right. Their problem was that they went and made a movie, and they just didn't need to make the movie.
Good movie, though.
Yeah.
Lot of confusion in these chubby Whataburger faces, so let me provide some clarification for you.
Wow, that's sacrilegious.
He did
Yes, he did
That's just amazing. I mean, come on, in professional football, it's really
a shame. Yes, that's what it is.
Yes,
you
it
can
is.
Argue all you want, but right. The flag, well, it's been thrown.
That's right. If it's three pumps, the ref's not going to take it away.
No,
now.
He's not. Duration and intensity doesn't make any difference.
Well, Jeff, let's have a look at the replay here to see if indeed he did do the three pumps.
All right, no question. There is the first one,
yeah,
right?
Agreed, right.
And then coming up is the second one.
Okay, yes, very clear. It's the third.
We'll see it. It's
just
coming up right here.
Oh, yeah, you're right. There's absolutely three pumps there.